in the future. For a moment, they were taken aback. We were pretty shocked, but we couldn't be frank, Siegel recalled. We were really thinking, Jesus, do they know what they are doing? It was so radical. Jobs asked them to suggest names. Siegel came back with five options, one of them, iMac. Jobs didn't like any of them at first, so Siegel came up with another list a week later, but he said that the agencies still preferred iMac. Jobs replied, I don't hate it this week, but I still don't like it. He tried silk screening it on some of the prototypes, and the name grew on him, and thus it became the iMac. As the deadline for completing the iMac drew near, Jobs's legendary temper reappeared in force, especially when he was confronting manufacturing issues. At one product review meeting, he learned that the process was going slowly. He did one of his displays of awesome fury, and the fury was absolutely pure, recalled Ive. He went around the table, assailing everyone, starting with Rubenstein. You know we're trying to save the company here, he shouted, and you guys are screwing it up. Like the original Macintosh team, the iMac crew staggered to completion just in time for the big announcement. But not before Jobs had one last explosion. When it came time to rehearse for the launch presentation, Rubenstein cobbled together two working prototypes. Jobs had not seen the final product before, and when he looked at it on stage, he saw a button on the front, under the display. He pushed it, and the CD tray opened. What the fuck is this? He asked, though not as politely. None of us said anything, Schiller recalled, because he obviously knew what a CD tray was. So Jobs continued to rail. It was supposed to have a clean CD slot, he insisted, referring to the elegant slot drives that were already to be found in upscale cars. Steve, this is exactly the drive I showed you when we talked about the components, Rubenstein explained. No, there was never a tray, just a slot, Jobs insisted. Rubenstein didn't back down. Jobs's fury didn't abate. I almost started crying because it was too late to do anything about it, Jobs later recalled. They suspended the rehearsal, and for a while it seemed as if Jobs might cancel the entire product launch. Ruby looked at me as if to say, Am I crazy? Schiller recalled. It was my first product launch with Steve, and the first time I saw his mindset of, If it's not right, we're not launching it. Finally, they agreed to replace the tray with a slot drive for the next version of the iMac. I'm only going to go ahead with the launch if you promise we're going to go to slot mode as soon as possible, Jobs said tearfully. There was also a problem with the video he planned to show. In it, Johnny Ive is shown describing his design thinking and asking, What computer would the Jetsons have had? It was like the future yesterday. At that moment, there was a 2-second snippet from the cartoon show showing Jane Jetson looking at a video screen, followed by another 2-second clip of the Jetsons giggling by a Christmas tree. At a rehearsal, a production assistant told Jobs they would have to remove the clips because Hanna-Barbera had not given permission to use them. Keep it in, Jobs barked at him. The assistant explained that there were rules against that. I don't care, Jobs said. We're using it. The clip stayed in. Lee Clow was preparing a series of colorful magazine ads, and when he sent Jobs the page proofs, he got an outraged phone call in response. The blue in the ad, Jobs insisted, was different from that of the iMac. You guys don't know what you're doing, Jobs shouted. I'm going to get someone else to do the ads because this is fucked up. Clow argued back. Compare them, he said. Jobs, who was not in the office, insisted he was right and continued to shout. Eventually, Clow got him to sit down with the original photographs. I finally proved to him that the blue was the blue was the blue. Years later, on a Steve Jobs discussion board on the website Gawker, the following tale appeared from someone who had worked at the Whole Foods store in Palo Alto, a few blocks from Jobs' home. "I was shagging carts one afternoon when I saw this silver Mercedes parked in a handicapped spot. Steve Jobs was inside screaming at his car phone. This was right before the first iMac was unveiled, and I'm pretty sure I could make out, 'Not fucking blue enough.'" As always, Jobs was compulsive in preparing for the dramatic unveiling. Having stopped one rehearsal because he was angry about the CD drive tray, he stretched out the other rehearsals to make sure the show would be stellar. He repeatedly went over the climactic moment when he would walk across the stage and proclaim, "Say hello to the new iMac." He wanted the lighting to be perfect so that the translucence of the new machine would be vivid. But after a few run-throughs, he was still unsatisfied, an echo of his obsession with stage lighting that Scully had witnessed at the rehearsals for the original 1984 Macintosh launch. He ordered the lights to be brighter and come on earlier, but that still didn't please him. So he jogged down the auditorium aisle and slouched into a center seat, draping his legs over the seat in front. "Let's keep doing it till we get it right, okay?" he said. They made another attempt. "No, no," Jobs complained. "This isn't working at all." The next time, the lights were bright enough, but they came on too late. "I'm getting tired of asking about this," Jobs growled. Finally, the iMac shone just right. "Oh, right there. That's great," Jobs yelled. A year earlier, Jobs had ousted Mike Markkula, his early mentor and partner, from the board. But he was so proud of what he had wrought with the new iMac, and so sentimental about its connection to the original Macintosh, that he invited Markkula to Cupertino for a private preview. Markkula was impressed. His only objection was to the new mouse that Ive had designed. It looked like a hockey puck, Markkula said, and people would hate it. Jobs disagreed, but Markkula was right. Otherwise, the machine had turned out to be, as had its predecessor, insanely great. The launch, May 6, 1998. With the launch of the original Macintosh in 1984, Jobs had created a new kind of theater. The product debut as an epical event, climaxed by a "let there be light" moment in which the skies part, a light shines down, the angels sing, and a chorus of the chosen faithful sings hallelujah. For the grand unveiling of the product that he hoped would save Apple and again transform personal computing, Jobs symbolically chose the Flint Auditorium of De Anza Community College in Cupertino, the same venue he had used in 1984. He would be pulling out all the stops in order to dispel doubts, rally the troops, enlist support in the developers' community, and jumpstart the marketing of the new machine. But he was also doing it because he enjoyed playing impresario. Putting on a great show piqued his passions in the same way as putting out a great product. Displaying his sentimental side, he began with a graceful shout-out to three people he had invited to be up front in the audience. He had become estranged from all of them, but now he wanted them rejoined. "I started the company with Steve Wozniak in my parents' garage, and Steve is here today," he said, pointing him out and prompting applause. "We were joined by Mike Markkula, and soon after that, our first president, Mike Scott," he continued. "Both of those folks are in the audience today, and none of us would be here without these three guys." His eyes misted for a moment as the applause again built. Also in the audience were Andy Hertzfeld and most of the original Mac team. Jobs gave them a smile. He believed he was about to do them proud. After showing the grid of Apple's new product strategy, and going through some slides about the new computer's performance, he was ready to unveil his new baby. "This is what computers look like today," he said as a picture of a beige set of boxy components and monitor was projected on the big screen behind him. "And I'd like to take the privilege of showing you what they are going to look like from today on." He pulled the cloth from the table at center stage to reveal the new iMac, which gleamed and sparkled as the lights came up on cue. He pressed the mouse, and as at the launch of the original Macintosh, the screen flashed with fast-paced images of all the wondrous things the computer could do. At the end, the word "Hello" appeared in the same playful script that had adorned the 1984 Macintosh, this time with the word "Again" below it in parentheses. "Hello, again." There was thunderous applause. Jobs stood back and proudly gazed at his new Macintosh. "It looks like it's from another planet," he said as the audience laughed. "A good planet. A planet with better designers." Once again, Jobs had produced an iconic new product, this one a harbinger of a new millennium. It fulfilled the promise of think different. Instead of beige boxes and monitors with a welter of cables and a bulky setup manual, here was a friendly and spunky appliance, smooth to the touch and as pleasing to the eye as a robin's egg. You could grab its cute little handle and lift it out of the elegant white box and plug it right into a wall socket. People who had been afraid of computers now wanted one, and they wanted to put it in a room where others could admire it and perhaps covet it. A piece of hardware that blends sci-fi shimmer with a kitsch whimsy of a cocktail umbrella, Stephen Levy wrote in Newsweek. "It is not only the coolest-looking computer introduced in years, but a chest-thumping statement that Silicon Valley's original dream company is no longer somnambulant." Forbes called it an industry-altering success, and John Sculley later came out of exile to gush, "He has implemented the same simple strategy that made Apple so successful 15 years ago. Make hit products and promote them with terrific marketing." Carping was heard from only one familiar corner. As the iMac garnered kudos, Bill Gates assured a gathering of financial analysts visiting Microsoft that this would be a passing fad. "The one thing Apple's providing now is leadership in colors," Gates said, as he pointed to a Windows-based PC that he jokingly had painted red. "It won't take long for us to catch up with that, I don't think." Jobs was furious, and he told a reporter that Gates, the man he had publicly decried for being completely devoid of taste, was clueless about what made the iMac so much more appealing than other computers. "The thing that our competitors are missing is that they think it's about fashion, and they think it's about surface appearance," he said. "They say, we'll slap a little color on this piece of junk computer, and we'll have one too." The iMac went on sale in August 1998 for $1,299. It sold 278,000 units in its first 6 weeks, and it would sell 800,000 by the end of the year, making it the fastest-selling computer in Apple history. Most notably, 32% of the sales went to people who were buying a computer for the first time, and another 12% to people who had been using Windows machines. Ives soon came up with four new juicy-looking colors in addition to Bondi Blue for the iMacs. Offering the same computer in five colors would, of course, create huge challenges for manufacturing, inventory, and distribution. At most companies, including even the old Apple, there would have been studies and meetings to look at the costs and benefits. But when Jobs looked at the new colors, he got totally psyched and summoned other executives over to the design studio. "We're going to do all sorts of colors," he told them excitedly. When they left, Ive looked at his team in amazement, In most places, that decision would have taken months, Ive recalled. Steve did it in a half hour. There was one other important refinement that Jobs wanted for the iMac, getting rid of that detested CD tray. "I've seen a slot load drive on a very high-end Sony stereo," he said, "so I went to the drive manufacturers and got them to do a slot load drive for us for the version of the iMac we did 9 months later." Rubenstein tried to argue him out of the change. He predicted that new drives would come along that could burn music onto CDs rather than merely play them, and they would be available in tray form before they were made to work in slots. "If you go to slots, you will always be behind on the technology," Rubenstein argued. "I don't care, that's what I want," Jobs snapped back. They were having lunch at a sushi bar in San Francisco, and Jobs insisted that they continue the conversation over a walk. "I want you to do the slot load drive for me as a personal favor," Jobs asked. Rubenstein agreed, of course, but he turned out to be right. Panasonic came out with a CD drive that could rip and burn music, and it was available first for computers that had old-fashioned tray loaders. The effects of this would ripple over the next few years. It would cause Apple to be slow in catering to users who wanted to rip and burn their own music, but that would then force Apple to be imaginative and bold in finding a way to leapfrog over its competitors when Jobs finally realized that he had to get into the music market. Chapter 28. CEO. Still crazy after all these years. Tim Cook. When Steve Jobs returned to Apple and produced the Think Different ads and the iMac in his first year, it confirmed what most people already knew, that he could be creative and a visionary. He had shown that during his first round at Apple. What was less clear was whether he could run a company. He had definitely not shown that during his first round. Jobs threw himself into the task with a detail-oriented realism that astonished those who were used to his fantasy that the rules of this universe need not apply to him. He became a manager, which is different from being an executive or visionary, and that pleasantly surprised me, recalled Ed Woolard, the board chair who lured him back. His management mantra was focus. He eliminated excess product lines and cut extraneous features in the new operating system software that Apple was developing. He let go of his control freak desire to manufacture products in his own factories and instead outsourced the making of everything from the circuit boards to the finished computers. And he enforced on Apple's suppliers a rigorous discipline. When he took over, Apple had more than 2 months' worth of inventory sitting in warehouses, more than any other tech company. Like eggs and milk, computers have a short shelf life, so this amounted to at least a $500 million hit to profits. By early 1998, he had halved that to a month. Jobs's successes came at a cost, since velvety diplomacy was still not part of his repertoire. When he decided that a division of Airborne Express wasn't delivering spare parts quickly enough, he ordered an Apple manager to break the contract. When the manager protested that doing so could lead to a lawsuit, Jobs replied, "Just tell them if they fuck with us, they'll never get another fucking dime from this company, ever." The manager quit. There was a lawsuit, and it took a year to resolve. "My stock options would be worth $10 million had I stayed," the manager said, "but I knew I couldn't have stood it, and he'd have fired me anyway." The new distributor was ordered to cut inventory 75% and did. Under Steve Jobs, there's a zero tolerance for not performing, its CEO said. At another point, when VLSI Technology was having trouble delivering enough chips on time, Jobs stormed into a meeting and started shouting that they were fucking dickless assholes. The company ended up getting the chips to Apple on time, and its executives made jackets that boasted on the back, Team FDA. After 3 months of working under Jobs, Apple's head of operations decided he could not bear the pressure, and he quit. For almost a year, Jobs ran operations himself, because all the prospects he interviewed seemed like they were old-wave manufacturing people, he recalled. He wanted someone who could build just-in-time factories and supply chains, as Michael Dell had done. Then, in 1998, he met Tim Cook, a courtly 37-year-old procurement and supply chain manager at Compaq Computers, who not only would become his operations manager, but would grow into an indispensable backstage partner in running Apple. As Jobs recalled, Tim Cook came out of procurement, which is just the right background for what we needed. I realized that he and I saw things exactly the same way. I had visited a lot of just-in-time factories in Japan, and I'd built one for the Mac and at Next. I knew what I wanted, and I met Tim, and he wanted the same thing. So we started to work together, and before long I trusted him to know exactly what to do. He had the same vision I did, and we could interact at a high strategic level, and I could just forget about a lot of things unless he came and pinged me. Cook, the son of a shipyard worker, was raised in Robertsdale, Alabama, a small town between Mobile and Pensacola, a half hour from the Gulf Coast. He majored in industrial engineering at Auburn, got a business degree at Duke, and for the next 12 years worked for IBM in the Research Triangle of North Carolina. When Jobs interviewed him, he had recently taken a job at Compaq. He had always been a very logical engineer, and Compaq then seemed a very sensible career option, but he was snared by Jobs' aura. 5 minutes into my initial interview with Steve, I wanted to throw caution and logic to the wind and join Apple, he later said. My intuition told me that joining Apple would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to work for a creative genius. And so he did. Engineers are taught to make a decision analytically, but there are times when relying on gut or intuition is most indispensable. At Apple, his role became implementing Jobs' intuition, which he accomplished with a quiet diligence. Never married, he threw himself into his work. He was up most days at 4:30 sending emails, then spent an hour at the gym and was at his desk shortly after 6. He scheduled Sunday evening conference calls to prepare for each week ahead. In a company that was led by a CEO prone to tantrums and withering blasts, Cook commanded situations with a calm demeanor, a soothing Alabama accent, and silent stares. Though he's capable of mirth, Cook's default facial expression is a frown, and his humor is of the dry variety, Adam Leshinsky wrote in Fortune. In meetings, he's known for long, uncomfortable pauses, when all you hear is the sound of his tearing the wrapper off the energy bars he constantly eats. At a meeting early in his tenure, Cook was told of a problem with one of Apple's Chinese suppliers. "This is really bad," he said. "Someone should be in China driving this." 30 minutes later, he looked at an operations executive sitting at the table and unemotionally asked, "Why are you still here?" The executive stood up, drove directly to the San Francisco airport, and bought a ticket to China. He became one of Cook's top deputies. Cook reduced the number of Apple's key suppliers from 100 to 24, forced them to cut better deals to keep the business, convinced many to locate next to Apple's plants, and closed 10 of the company's 19 warehouses. By reducing the places where inventory could pile up, he reduced inventory. Jobs had cut inventory from 2 months' worth of product down to 1 by early 1998. By September of that year, Cook had gotten it down to 6 days. By the following September, it was down to an amazing 2 days' worth. In addition, he cut the production process for making an Apple computer from 4 months to 2. All of this not only saved money, it also allowed each new computer to have the very latest components available. Mock turtlenecks and teamwork. On a trip to Japan in the early 1980s, Jobs asked Sony's chairman, Akio Morita, why everyone in his company's factories wore uniforms. "He looked very ashamed and told me that after the war, no one had any clothes, and companies like Sony had to give their workers something to wear each day," Jobs recalled. Over the years, the uniforms developed their own signature style, especially at companies such as Sony, and it became a way of bonding workers to the company. "I decided I wanted that type of bonding for Apple," Jobs recalled. Sony, with its appreciation for style, had gotten the famous designer Issey Miyake to create its uniform. It was a jacket made of ripstop nylon with sleeves that could unzip to make it a vest. "So I called Issey and asked him to design a vest for Apple," Jobs recalled. "I came back with some samples and told everyone it would be great if we would all wear these vests. Oh man, did I get booed off the stage. Everybody hated the idea." In the process, however, he became friends with Miyake and would visit him regularly. He also came to like the idea of having a uniform for himself, because of both its daily convenience, the rationale he claimed, and its ability to convey a signature style. "So I asked Issey to make me some of his black turtlenecks that I liked, and he made me like 100 of them." Jobs noticed my surprise when he told this story, so he gestured to them stacked up in the closet. "That's what I wear," he said. "I have enough to last for the rest of my life." Despite his autocratic nature, he never worshipped at the altar of consensus, Jobs worked hard to foster a culture of collaboration at Apple. Many companies pride themselves on having few meetings. Jobs had many: an executive staff session every Monday, a marketing strategy session all Wednesday afternoon, and endless product review sessions. Still allergic to PowerPoints and formal presentations, he insisted that the people around the table hash out ideas from various vantages and the perspectives of different departments. Because he believed that Apple's great advantage was its integration of the whole widget, from design to hardware to software to content, he wanted all departments at the company to work together in parallel. The phrases he used were deep collaboration and concurrent engineering. Instead of a development process in which a product would be passed sequentially from engineering to design to manufacturing to marketing and distribution, these various departments collaborated simultaneously. "Our method was to develop integrated products, and that meant our process had to be integrated and collaborative," Jobs said. This approach also applied to key hires. He would have candidates meet the top leaders, Cook, Devanian, Schiller, Rubinstein, Ive, rather than just the managers of the department where they wanted to work. "Then we all get together without the person and talk about whether they'll fit in," Jobs said. His goal was to be vigilant against the bozo explosion that leads to a company's being larded with second-rate talent. For most things in life, the range between best and average is 30% or so. The best airplane flight, the best meal, they may be 30% better than your average one. What I saw with Woz was somebody who was 50 times better than the average engineer. He could have meetings in his head. The Mac team was an attempt to build a whole team like that, A players. People said they wouldn't get along. They'd hate working with each other. But I realized that A players liked to work with A players. They just didn't like working with C players. At Pixar, it was a whole company of A players. When I got back to Apple, that's what I decided to try to do. You need to have a collaborative hiring process. When we hire someone, even if they're going to be in marketing, I will have them talk to the design folks and the engineers. My role model was J. Robert Oppenheimer. I read about the type of people he sought for the Atom Bomb Project. I wasn't nearly as good as he was, but that's what I aspired to do. The process could be intimidating, but Jobs had an eye for talent. When they were looking for people to design the graphical interface for Apple's new operating system, Jobs got an email from a young man and invited him in. The applicant was nervous, and the meeting did not go well. Later that day, Jobs bumped into him, dejected, sitting in the lobby. The guy asked if he could just show him one of his ideas, so Jobs looked over his shoulder and saw a little demo using Adobe Director of a way to fit more icons in the dock at the bottom of a screen. When the guy moved the cursor over the icons crammed into the dock, the cursor mimicked a magnifying glass and made each icon balloon bigger. "I said, my God," and hired him on the spot, Jobs recalled. The feature became a lovable part of Mac OS X, and the designer went on to design such things as inertial scrolling for multi-touch screens, the delightful feature that makes the screen keep gliding for a moment after you've finished swiping. Jobs' experiences at Next had matured him, but they had not mellowed him much. He still had no license plate on his Mercedes, and he still parked in the handicapped spaces next to the front door, sometimes straddling two slots. It became a running gag. Employees made signs saying, "Park different," and someone painted over the handicap wheelchair symbol with a Mercedes logo. People were allowed, even encouraged, to challenge him, and sometimes he would respect them for it. But you had to be prepared for him to attack you, even bite your head off, as he processed your ideas. You never win an argument with him at the time, but sometimes you eventually win, said James Vincent, the creative young ad man who worked with Lee Clow. You propose something, and he declares, "That's a stupid idea." And later he comes back and says, "Here's what we're going to do." And you want to say, "That's what I told you 2 weeks ago, and you said that's a stupid idea." But you can't do that. Instead, you say, "That's a great idea. Let's do that." People also had to put up with Jobs's occasional irrational or incorrect assertions. To both family and colleagues, he was apt to declare, with great conviction, some scientific or historical fact that had scant relationship to reality. There can be something he knows absolutely nothing about, and because of his crazy style and utter conviction, he can convince people that he knows what he's talking about, said Ive, who described the trait as weirdly endearing. Yet with his eye for detail, Jobs sometimes correctly pounced on tiny things others had missed. Lee Clow recalled showing Jobs a cut of a commercial, making some minor changes he requested, and then being assaulted with a tirade about how the ad had been completely destroyed. He discovered we had cut two extra frames, something so fleeting it was nearly impossible to notice, said Clow. But he wanted to be sure that an image hit at the exact moment as a beat of the music, and he was totally right. From iCEO to CEO. Ed Woolard, his mentor on the Apple board, pressed Jobs for more than 2 years to drop the interim in front of his CEO title. Not only was Jobs refusing to commit himself, but he was baffling everyone by taking only $1 a year in pay and no stock options. I make 50 cents for showing up, he liked to joke, and the other 50 cents is based on performance. Since his return in July 1997, Apple stock had gone from just under $14 to just over $102 at the peak of the internet bubble at the beginning of 2000. Woolard had begged him to take at least a modest stock grant back in 1997, but Jobs had declined, saying, I don't want the people I work with at Apple to think I am coming back to get rich. Had he accepted that modest grant, it would have been worth $400 million. Instead, he made $2.50 during that period. The main reason he clung to his interim designation was a sense of uncertainty about Apple's future. But as 2000 approached, it was clear that Apple had rebounded, and it was because of him. He took a long walk with Laureen and discussed what to most people by now seemed a formality, but to him was still a big deal. If he dropped the interim designation, Apple could be the base for all the things he envisioned, including the possibility of getting Apple into products beyond computers. He decided to do so. Woolard was thrilled, and he suggested that the board was willing to give him a massive stock grant. Let me be straight with you, Jobs replied. What I'd rather have is an airplane. We just had a third kid. I don't like flying commercial. I like to take my family to Hawaii. When I go east, I'd like to have pilots I know. He was never the type of person who could display grace and patience in a commercial airplane or terminal, even before the days of the TSA. Board member Larry Ellison, whose plane Jobs sometimes used, Apple paid $102,000 to Ellison in 1999 for Jobs' use of it, had no qualms. Given what he's accomplished, we should give him 5 airplanes, Ellison argued. He later said it was the perfect thank you gift for Steve, who had saved Apple and gotten nothing in return. So Woolard happily granted Jobs' wish with a Gulfstream 5 and also offered him 14 million stock options. Jobs gave an unexpected response. He wanted more. 20 million options. Woolard was baffled and upset. The board had authority from the stockholders to give out only 14 million. You said you didn't want any, and we gave you a plane, which you did want, Woolard said. I hadn't been insisting on options before, Jobs replied, but you suggested it could be up to 5% of the company in options, and that's what I now want. It was an awkward tiff in what should have been a celebratory period. In the end, a complex solution was worked out that granted him 10 million shares in January 2000 that were valued at the current price, but timed to vest as if granted in 1997, plus another grant due in 2001. Making matters worse, the stock fell with the burst of the internet bubble. Jobs never exercised the options, and at the end of 2001, he asked that they be replaced by a new grant with a lower strike price. The wrestling over options would come back to haunt the company. Even if he didn't profit from the options, at least he got to enjoy the airplane. Not surprisingly, he fretted over how the interior would be designed. It took him more than a year. He used Ellison's plane as a starting point and hired his designer. Pretty soon he was driving her crazy. For example, Ellison's had a door between cabins with an open button and a close button. Jobs insisted that his have a single button that toggled. He didn't like the polished stainless steel of the buttons, so he had them replaced with brushed metal ones. But in the end, he got the plane he wanted, and he loved it. I look at his airplane and mine, and everything he changed was better, said Ellison. At the January 2000 Macworld in San Francisco, Jobs rolled out the new Macintosh operating system, OS X, which used some of the software that Apple had bought from Next 3 years earlier. It was fitting, and not entirely coincidental, that he was willing to incorporate himself back at Apple at the same moment as the next OS was incorporated into Apple's. Avi Tavanian had taken the Unix-related mock kernel of the next operating system and turned it into the Mac OS kernel known as Darwin. It offered protected memory, advanced networking, and preemptive multitasking. It was precisely what the Macintosh needed, and it would be the foundation of the Mac OS henceforth. Some critics, including Bill Gates, noted that Apple ended up not adopting the entire next operating system. There's some truth to that, because Apple decided not to leap into a completely new system, but instead to evolve the existing one. Application software written for the old Macintosh system was generally compatible or easy to port to the new one, and a Mac user who upgraded would notice a lot of new features, but not a whole new interface. The fans at Macworld received the news with enthusiasm, of course, and they especially cheered when Jobs showed off the dock and how the icons in it could be magnified by passing the cursor over them. But the biggest applause came for the announcement he reserved for his, "Oh, and one more thing" coda. He spoke about his duties at both Pixar and Apple and said that he had become comfortable that the situation could work. "So I am pleased to announce today that I'm going to drop the interim title," he said with a big smile. The crowd jumped to its feet, screaming as if the Beatles had reunited. Jobs bit his lip, adjusted his wire rims, and put on a graceful show of humility. "You guys are making me feel funny now. I get to come to work every day and work with the most talented people on the planet, at Apple and Pixar. But these jobs are team sports. I accept your thanks on behalf of everybody at Apple." Chapter 29. Apple Stores. Genius Bars and Sienna Sandstone. The Customer Experience. Jobs hated to cede control of anything, especially when it might affect the customer experience. But he faced a problem. There was one part of the process he didn't control, the experience of buying an Apple product in a store. The days of the Byte shop were over. Industry sales were shifting from local computer specialty shops to mega chains and big box stores, where most clerks had neither the knowledge nor the incentive to explain the distinctive nature of Apple products. All that the salesman cared about was a $50 spiff, Jobs said. Other computers were pretty generic, but Apple's had innovative features and a higher price tag. He didn't want an iMac to sit on a shelf between a Dell and a Compaq while a uniformed clerk recited the specs of each. Unless we could find ways to get our message to customers at the store, we were screwed. In great secrecy, Jobs began in late 1999 to interview executives who might be able to develop a string of Apple retail stores. One of the candidates had a passion for design and the boyish enthusiasm of a natural-born retailer, Ron Johnson, the vice president for merchandising at Target, who was responsible for launching distinctive-looking products, such as a tea kettle designed by Michael Graves. "Steve is very easy to talk to," said Johnson in recalling their first meeting. "All of a sudden, there's a torn pair of jeans and turtleneck, and he's off and running about why he needed great stores. If Apple is going to succeed," he told me, "we're going to win on innovation, and you can't win on innovation unless you have a way to communicate to customers." When Johnson came back in January 2000 to be interviewed again, Jobs suggested that they take a walk. They went to the sprawling 140-store Stanford Shopping Mall at 8:30 a.m. The stores weren't open yet, so they walked up and down the entire mall repeatedly and discussed how it was organized, what role the big department stores played relative to the other stores, and why certain specialty shops were successful. They were still walking and talking when the stores opened at 10, and they went into Eddie Bauer. It had an entrance off the mall and another off the parking lot. Jobs decided that Apple's store should have only one entrance, which would make it easier to control the experience. And the Eddie Bauer store, they agreed, was too long and narrow. It was important that customers intuitively grasp the layout of a store as soon as they entered. There were no tech stores in the mall, and Johnson explained why. The conventional wisdom was that a consumer, when making a major and infrequent purchase, such as a computer, would be willing to drive to a less convenient location where the rent would be cheaper. Jobs disagreed. Apple stores should be in malls and on main streets, in areas with a lot of foot traffic, no matter how expensive. We may not be able to get them to drive 10 miles to check out our products, but we can get them to walk 10 feet, he said. The Windows users, in particular, had to be ambushed. If they're passing by, they will drop in out of curiosity. If we make it inviting enough, and once we get a chance to show them what we have, we will win. Johnson said that the size of a store signaled the importance of the brand. Is Apple as big of a brand as The Gap? He asked. Jobs said it was much bigger. Johnson replied that its stores should therefore be bigger. Otherwise, you won't be relevant. Jobs described Mike Markkula's maxim that a good company must impute. It must convey its values and importance in everything it does, from packaging to marketing. Johnson loved it. It definitely applied to a company's stores. The store will become the most powerful physical expression of the brand, he predicted. He said that when he was young, he had gone to the wood-paneled, art-filled, mansion-like store that Ralph Lauren had created at 72nd and Madison in Manhattan. Whenever I buy a polo shirt, I think of that mansion, which was a physical expression of Ralph's ideals, Johnson said. Mickey Drexler did that with The Gap. You couldn't think of a Gap product without thinking of the great Gap store with the clean space and wood floors and white walls and folded merchandise. When they finished, they drove to Apple and sat in a conference room playing with the company's products. There weren't many, not enough to fill the shelves of a conventional store, but that was an advantage. The type of store they would build, they decided, would benefit from having few products. It would be minimalist and airy and offer a lot of places for people to try out things. Most people don't know Apple products, Johnson said. They think of Apple as a cult. You want to move from a cult to something cool, and having an awesome store where people can try things will help that. The stores would impute the ethos of Apple products: playful, easy, creative, and on the bright side of the line between hip and intimidating. The prototype. When Jobs finally presented the idea, the board was not thrilled. Gateway Computers was going down in flames after opening suburban stores, and Jobs's argument that his would do better because they would be in more expensive locations was not, on its face, reassuring. Think Different and Here's to the Crazy Ones made for good advertising slogans, but the board was hesitant to make them guidelines for corporate strategy. I'm scratching my head and thinking, this is crazy, recalled Art Levinson, the CEO of Genentech, who joined the Apple board in 2000. We are a small company, a marginal player. I said that I'm not sure I can support something like this. Ed Woolard was also dubious. Gateway has tried this and failed, while Dell is selling direct to customers without stores and succeeding, he argued. Jobs was not appreciative of too much pushback from the board. The last time that happened, he had replaced most of the members. This time, for personal reasons, as well as being tired of playing tug-of-war with Jobs, Woolard decided to step down. But before he did, the board approved a trial run of 4 Apple stores. Jobs did have one supporter on the board. In 1999, he had recruited the Bronx-born retailing prince Millard Mickey Drexler, who, as CEO of Gap, had transformed a sleepy chain into an icon of American casual culture. He was one of the few people in the world who were as successful and savvy as Jobs on matters of design, image, and consumer yearnings. In addition, he had insisted on end-to-end control. Gap stores sold only Gap products, and Gap products were sold almost exclusively in Gap stores. I left the department store business because I couldn't stand not controlling my own product, from how it's manufactured to how it's sold, Drexler said. Steve is just that way, which is why I think he recruited me. Drexler gave Jobs a piece of advice. Secretly build a prototype of the store near the Apple campus, furnish it completely, and then hang out there until you feel comfortable with it. So Johnson and Jobs rented a vacant warehouse in Cupertino. Every Tuesday for 6 months, they convened an all-morning brainstorming session there, refining their retailing philosophy as they walked the space. It was the store equivalent of Ives Design Studio, a haven where Jobs, with his visual approach, could come up with innovations by touching and seeing the options as they evolved. I loved to wander over there on my own, just checking it out, Jobs recalled. Sometimes he made Drexler, Larry Ellison, and other trusted friends come look. On too many weekends, when he wasn't making me watch new scenes from Toy Story, he made me go to the warehouse and look at the mock-ups for the store, Ellison said. He was obsessed by every detail of the aesthetic and the service experience. It got to the point where I said, Steve, I'm not coming to see you if you're going to make me go to the store again. Ellison's company, Oracle, was developing software for the handheld checkout system, which avoided having a cash register counter. On each visit, Jobs prodded Ellison to figure out ways to streamline the process by eliminating some unnecessary step, such as handing over the credit card or printing a receipt. If you look at the stores and the products, you will see Steve's obsession with beauty as simplicity, this Bauhaus aesthetic and wonderful minimalism, which goes all the way to the checkout process in the stores, said Ellison. It means the absolute minimum number of steps. Steve gave us the exact, explicit recipe for how he wanted the checkout to work. When Drexler came to see the prototype, he had some criticisms. I thought the space was too chopped up and not clean enough. There were too many distracting architectural features and colors. He emphasized that a customer should be able to walk into a retail space and with one sweep of the eye, understand the flow. Jobs agreed that simplicity and lack of distractions were keys to a great store, as they were to a product. After that, he nailed it, said Drexler. The vision he had was complete control of the entire experience of his product, from how it was designed and made to how it was sold. In October 2000, near what he thought was the end of the process, Johnson woke up in the middle of a night before one of the Tuesday meetings with a painful thought. They had gotten something fundamentally wrong. They were organizing the store around each of Apple's main product lines, with areas for the Power Mac, iMac, iBook, and PowerBook. But Jobs had begun developing a new concept, the computer as a hub for all your digital activity. In other words, your computer might handle video and pictures from your cameras, and perhaps someday your music player and songs, or your books and magazines. Johnson's pre-dawn brainstorm was that the store should organize displays not just around the company's 4 lines of computers, but also around things people might want to do. For example, I thought there should be a movie bay where we'd have various Macs and PowerBooks running iMovie and showing how you can import from your video camera and edit. Johnson arrived at Jobs' office early that Tuesday and told him about his sudden insight that they needed to reconfigure the stores. He had heard tales of his boss's intemperate tongue, but he had not yet felt its lash until now. Jobs erupted. "Do you know what a big change this is?" he yelled. "I've worked my ass off on this store for 6 months, and now you want to change everything." Jobs suddenly got quiet. "I'm tired. I don't know if I can design another store from scratch." Johnson was speechless, and Jobs made sure he remained so. On the ride to the prototype store, where people had gathered for the Tuesday meeting, he told Johnson not to say a word, either to him or to the other members of the team. So the 7-minute drive proceeded in silence. When they arrived, Jobs had finished processing the information. "I knew Ron was right," he recalled. So to Johnson's surprise, Jobs opened the meeting by saying, "Ron thinks we've got it all wrong. He thinks it should be organized not around products, but instead around what people do." There was a pause. Then Jobs continued, "And you know, he's right." He said they would redo the layout, even though it would likely delay the planned January rollout by 3 or 4 months. "We've only got one chance to get it right." Jobs liked to tell the story, and he did so to his team that day, about how everything that he had done correctly had required a moment when he hit the rewind button. In each case, he had to rework something that he discovered was not perfect. He talked about doing it on Toy Story when the character of Woody had evolved into being a jerk, and on a couple of occasions with the original Macintosh. "If something isn't right, you can't just ignore it and say you'll fix it later," he said. "That's what other companies do." When the revised prototype was finally completed in January 2001, Jobs allowed the board to see it for the first time. He explained the theories behind the design by sketching on a whiteboard, then he loaded board members into a van for the 2-mile trip. When they saw what Jobs and Johnson had built, they unanimously approved going ahead. It would, the board agreed, take the relationship between retailing and brand image to a new level. It would also ensure that consumers did not see Apple computers as merely a commodity product like Dell or Compaq. Most outside experts disagreed. "Maybe it's time Steve Jobs stopped thinking quite so differently," Business Week wrote in a story headlined, "Sorry, Steve, here's why Apple stores won't work." Apple's former chief financial officer, Joseph Graziano, was quoted as saying, "Apple's problem is it still believes the way to grow is serving caviar in a world that seems pretty content with cheese and crackers." And the retail consultant David Goldstein declared, "I give them 2 years before they're turning out the lights on a very painful and expensive mistake." Wood, stone, steel, glass. On May 19, 2001, the first Apple store opened in Tysons Corner, Virginia, with gleaming white counters, bleached wood floors, and a huge Think Different poster of John and Yoko in bed. The skeptics were wrong. Gateway stores had been averaging 250 visitors a week. By 2004, Apple stores were averaging 5,400 per week. That year, the stores had $1.2 billion in revenue, setting a record in the retail industry for reaching the billion-dollar milestone. Sales in each store were tabulated every 4 minutes by Ellison's software, giving instant information on how to integrate manufacturing, supply, and sales channels. As the stores flourished, Jobs stayed involved in every aspect. Lee Clow recalled, In one of our marketing meetings, just as the stores were opening, Steve made us spend a half hour deciding what hue of gray the restroom signs should be. The architectural firm of Bolin Sawinski Jackson designed the signature stores, but Jobs made all of the major decisions.